Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. We are continuing today with more coverage of the Santa Fe Film Festival, which opens and actually starts today, runs through Sunday. You can find them at santafefilmfestival.com and at 988-7414 right here in Santa Fe. I'd like now to introduce filmmaker Danny Ladoni. His film Playing Columbine is screening this week at the film festival, actually on Friday and Sunday of this week. Welcome, Danny, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you are the creator of a video game called Super Columbine Massacre RPG, which is based on the facts of the Columbine High School shootings and is available for free on the internet. You're from Colorado. You had been really influenced by the Columbine shootings and always wanted to create a video game. Why this subject for the video game?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that was important to me when I came across this software program that I, as a non-game designer, have a background in film production, that I could make a video game, it occurred to me that I wanted to make a game about something that was personally important, and I wanted to make a game that kind of made use of the medium of video games to kind of critique a lot of the issues therein. And because Columbine was a subject that had been important to me since I was in high school at the time in Colorado and had kind of a lot of the same experiences being bullied or ostracized, or that I liked the same kinds of music or video games as the actual shooters, it became clear to me that I could use the medium of the video game to create a kind of commentary about Columbine itself.
So RPG, which is in the name of the game, stands for role-playing game, and the players who play the game actually put themselves in the roles of the two shooters, the Columbine shooters. What is the rationale for putting people in their shoes, and what information about them did you give the players to work with?
Right, well, I think one of the first assumptions people make when they hear about the idea that there's a video game about Columbine is they assume that it's a first-person or kind of a third-person Grand Theft Auto-style shooting game, when in fact it looks more like a 16-bit video game from the Super Nintendo era circa 1992. So the idea there was to really envelop the player in a story, and in order to do so, like most role-playing games, there are characters, there's dialogue, there's flashbacks, there's other elements that we sort of recognize in traditional storytelling. And so what I did during the sort of development period of the game was doing a lot of research on the shooting itself, getting a lot of the video diaries, the journals, other eyewitness accounts of the shooting, and tried to recreate the last day, if you will, in the lives of these two shooters. And I did so because I felt like the media in general really made a caricature of these two kids to the point where we projected on them a lot of our own cultural fears about video games we didn't play, music we didn't like, you know, aspects of our culture that some of us maybe found worrisome, and we weren't really willing to listen to what they had to say or acknowledge the kind of experiences that they had had up until that point in April of 1999. So this game is a way to kind of give players a chance to step into that perspective and understand, though it may be difficult, why they would have done something like this.
Which is a question that I think is really under-asked. People talk about the horror of things like this, and they make the assumption, and this happens in the media, that these people were on some level evil or horrible people, and your game, I think, tries to go deeper than that.
I mean, it's certainly possible that that there are steps that we can take in a simplified way to reduce the number of school shootings or the amount of violence that would occur during one. But the underlying problems here that are certainly are not limited to Columbine, unfortunately, they're ongoing, are deeper questions that we should ask ourselves. And, you know, instead of looking for simple solutions, a video game or a book or a movie may ask us to introspect and try and find some deeper answers as to why these things happen.
So for a while you were anonymous after you put this game on the internet, but then your identity as the creator of the game became known. What was the reaction from the public when people found out about it and found out who you were? What was the reaction toward you?
Well, first of all, people ask me about if there's any mistakes or anything that I would do over if I could do it again. And I think being anonymous for over a year when the game was first released on the internet would be that thing. If it were up to me, I would do it all over again by being the sort of named, signed work of the game from the beginning, because it created what I feel is the wrong kind of controversy. The controversy should never have been about the fact that I was found out or who made the Columbine game, but rather, can video games like this provoke these kinds of questions or discussions? But the reaction, as you can imagine, was at least initially very, very much a kind of outrage, you know, basically among people who never played the game to begin with, but were just reacting to the idea that a video game could cover a subject like Columbine, and that that someone would have made this game and put it on the internet. So that was kind of the initial shock or outrage that people expressed. And as I think the film documents, this reaction kind of changed, at least among some people, when they actually began to dig deeper into what the game was about.
The film that you've made, Playing Columbine, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival this week, is incredibly rich in ideas, and I have to say it really changed my mind about the whole subject of video games, which I have not, I play a little bit, but I'm not a person who plays a lot of video games. And so I am part of that generation and that group of people whom the film discusses who really are willing to talk about something without having the slightest idea what they're talking about, without having played it. And one of the ideas that opened my mind about video games was the idea that they were an art form or a potential art form, and that they were in some way a storytelling medium or could serve that role. So talk to us about the potential role of video games, of games, as an art form. What is the nature of that art, and to what extent are games actually fulfilling that potential?
Right. I mean, it should be pointed out, first of all, as the film points out, that there was a judge in 2002 who ruled in a lower court case that video games are not a form of artistic expression, that they don't contain any conveyance of ideas or what we would esteem art to be. But in fact, and that ruling was later overturned, but video games are at least as much an art form as the existing ones that we recognize, right? It contains music, it contains, you know, the graphic arts, it contains storytelling, it contains cinematic movement or camera work, all the things that we contemporarily recognize as art. So the question is, what makes video games a unique art form? And I think a lot of game designers that I spoke with throughout the film point to the idea of authorship, that the player can take a part in telling the story, that the player can have a kind of meaningful in-game experience, that that by taking on a role, whether it's the role of a superhero or a football star or even someone misunderstood, like the Columbine killers, we can learn more about ourselves. And that ultimately is not the value of games specifically, but the value of role-playing in general, the value of taking on someone else's identity or a different perspective and understanding how we can apply that to our lives in some way.
So that is something that your game does, and that some of the other video games about real-life issues. There's one about Darfur. There's one called September 12th, which are discussed in the film Playing Columbine. But it seems like a lot of the video games that are actually out there are kind of the equivalent of mindless action movies. I mean, is this potential that you talk about really being fulfilled?
Well, I know that in some ways the film is a critique of the mainstream game industry. As someone who grew up playing video games and then kind of abandoned them in college for want of kind of deeper or more philosophically satisfying experiences, I began to ask myself why video games couldn't encompass that anymore. And it's by no fault the game design medium. It's not really the issue of interactivity in general. It's what kinds of roles are we giving players the chance to play? And a lot of them really are sort of male power fantasies. You know, the 14-year-old that we imagine all games are designed for is sort of diminishing. And as the film points out, the average age of a gamer is now about 32 or 33 years old. So we want different kinds of experiences in our games. And much like movies, not every film is going to be a deep investigative treatise on some issue. We still like our action movies. You know, we still, if you look at the box office sales, that's pretty clear. But video games are beginning to carve out a space where we can achieve things other than escapist entertainment. But how far we get with that, what kind of market is established for that, are people even going to pay money to play games like this? All the games I feature, almost all of them, are available for free online. No one is going to Best Buy to buy games like this yet. But I predict that someday we're going to see more mainstream titles that deal with political issues in the same way that, that books or documentary films or other kinds of media do.
We're talking to Danny Ladone. He is the filmmaker who made the documentary Playing Columbine, which is screening this week at the Santa Fe Film Festival. You give this issue a very thorough exploration, the issue of video games, in your film, including the points of view of many of the detractors of video games, your own and other video games. So the one question that I think is worth talking about on the air right now is the question of whether violent video games foster violent behavior. What is your perspective on this?
Yeah, I think part of the reason I made the film is because the Columbine game itself set up a perfect storm around a lot of the issues that video games in general face. And one of the main issues, of course, is the concern that video games cause real-world violence or some kind of moral decay, which, as the film points out, is not a unique controversy to video games. We have historically issues around almost every medium, you know, from theater in ancient Athens to, you know, more recently with jazz music or rock and roll or comic books or films. Every medium seems to go through this rite of passage whereby the older generation fears or doesn't understand something that the younger generation is into, and so they ascribe all of the ills of society onto that particular misunderstood medium. Video games, I think, unfortunately, have it particularly bad because video games seem to have the most narrow scope of what games are about. Video games have traditionally been about, you know, violent conflict, and so it goes without saying that maybe some people are concerned about that. I don't personally believe that any book or any film or any video game or any music is going to compel someone to do something they wouldn't otherwise do. I think ultimately it is a question of balance and perspective. And one of the detractors of video game violence is Jack Thompson, who is a former attorney in Florida. And he's in the film and he points out that that if you give someone a choice between having their child read the Bible for 15 hours a day or play Grand Theft Auto San Andreas for the same number of hours, most parents would take their chances with the Bible, he says. But I think that's a really disingenuous, false dichotomy, because I think anything you do for 15 hours a day is probably a bad idea. So it is ultimately a question of, you know, putting video games or, you know, putting really anything, fast food or whatever you like to do, in perspective, and being able to kind of have a balanced media diet.
There is the question of addiction. I mean, it is easy to get, even I had was addicted to one of those little games until I got tendonitis from playing it too much. And for kids who are addicted to a game and who use that time doing that and not going out and running around and getting fresh air, I mean, it seems like that's probably as much of an issue as anything else.
Yeah, there are a few issues around video games right now. One is video game violence, another is video game addiction. And we're seeing that particularly with a lot of immersive, massive multiplayer online games like World of Warcraft or, you know, games like that where players literally spend hundreds of hours in this virtual world. And, you know, certainly that is a concern. And I think the question is really one of addiction, which we see spanning all sorts of issues from alcoholism and gambling to, you know, a number of other things. And so it maybe is more of a question of addictive personalities and how we can address those issues rather than any specific thing. We certainly, I don't think we should make the case that because some video game players are addicted to a particular video game or that lifestyle, that we should therefore legislate or some in other ways impose limits on the creative development of that medium.
The underlying question that we see throughout the film and in the questions surrounding your game and the questions about violence is ultimately the question of what kind of society we're living in which we have such a need to escape into games, and in which so much violence is represented not only in games but in the movies and everything else. And I think that's a question that you address pretty eloquently.
I mean, that's a huge issue, and I could devote an entire film or an entire kind of series of television shows about that issue, actually. Why is it that so much of the media that we consume, whether it's books, video games, movies, whatever, is really dedicated to helping us to forget our lives and forget our own problems? I mean, I sat through all the Lord of the Rings movies, and I love them. So I think a little bit of escapism is healthy for everyone. But if, as the college professor I interview from Emerson College says is true, which is that we spend our waking lives outside of work and outside of things like that, we spend almost all of our time at our computer monitors or in front of our TV sets or those things, then maybe there is a problem there. And maybe we should start thinking about how, instead of escaping, we can address the root causes of some of these problems that we have.
Danny Ladone is the filmmaker whose documentary Playing Columbine screens at the Santa Fe Film Festival this week. You can see it on Friday at 2:15 and then again on Sunday at 7:15 at Warehouse 21. Danny, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by phone, Tony Barbieri. He is the writer and director of the film called M, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival this week, and Jim Germanic, who is the producer of the film. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
This is a stunning film. It's a narrative film about a young couple who fall deeply in love, and the woman suffers from a mental illness, bipolar illness. And it explores in a way that is so subtle and so beautifully crafted the illness itself and the relationship between these two people. Clearly, you guys who made this film have a deep understanding of this illness. What was the inspiration for the story?
It's based on a relationship that I had with a girl that I was with for quite some time. And what prompted me to write the script was that my experience with bipolar disorder was different from how it's typically portrayed in television and film. It was much more subtle. It didn't have all of the obvious warning signs that you often see portrayed, like I said, television and film. So that's what prompted me to write it was this fine line between normal behavior and mental illness that really fascinated me. So
one of the things that I love about the film is that it is precisely that subtlety and that walking the line between normal and mentally ill. And even when the woman is what we might call over the line, there's never any like grand dramatics. Even when she's a little crazy, the viewer is left wondering what's going on here instead of seeing what is clearly a deranged person.
Exactly. And that's what we all really tried to portray this disorder in that way. I thought it was very important. Jim, do you want to talk about how you saw it?
I mean, what really struck a chord for me when I initially wrote the script, Tony asked me for some comments on it. I knew some people who I was very close to in my life and still continue to be, who have bipolar disorder and other forms of mental illness, and they were quite in contrast to how it's portrayed in TV and films. And what I loved about the script and what I love about the film is that it's a very raw and natural and real, genuine look at mental illness.
I think the rawness and realness comes out in so many different ways, and one of them is the way you cast these two people. On the one hand, they're very beautiful, but they're so un-Hollywood in their beauty. They're just genuine, real people who are living lives that probably most of us could imagine living or on some level have lived.
Yeah, that was very important. The casting was essential to this film. I thought that we didn't want to cast exactly what you just said, the typical Hollywood types. We wanted to cast real-looking people that definitely have charisma, but are people that you can relate to. So that was very important part of the process.
And who have incredible chemistry with each other.
I believe so too. I think that they had great chemistry. So that was without that, I don't think we would have had a film. I think we, for the reasons that you just stated, we really needed to cast the right people, and I think we did.
You know, Tony, like all great directors, Tony is insanely selective, and he actually went through like 1,400 people for these roles. 1,400 people on because on the internet now you can see a lot more people than you would in a casting session with a professional casting director. So he went through a lot of people to find these two actors.
Amazing. Another part of it is the effect of mental illness on the partner, on the lover, on the person who thinks erroneously that love can conquer all. And I guess you've been in that position.
Exactly. Yes, I have. And it's hard because, like I said earlier, when you have this fine line between normal behavior and mental illness, it's so easy to get sucked into it and kind of lose perspective. There were times when I was with this person for quite some time, and I even after years into it, I still thought that this person was normal and healthy, and they just weren't. It's tricky when you're in that type of situation without these obvious warning signs. It's kind of difficult to see it for how it really is.
We're talking about the film M, which, ladies and gentlemen, is spelled E-M if you're looking for it on the film festival schedule. And we're talking to writer-director Tony Barbieri and producer Jim Germanic. I was watching this film. I was screening it with two friends, both of whom, all of us have either known or been in a relationship with people with various mental illnesses. And one of my friends said, "Isn't it funny how mental illness is contagious?" And the other one said, "Yes, but you don't get the same illness that the person has whom you're with."
Exactly.
And it led to a very interesting discussion about that. Talk more about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely its own world, and you, like I said earlier, it's so easy to get sucked into this world and start to take on traits, or your life definitely starts to change. I know that mine did, and people around me would even say that you just start changing in various ways. So, that definitely happened with me.
As I was watching the film, I was struck by the incredible editing and the way that you do not over-explain what's going on. You leave a lot to the viewer, and yet the viewer is able to do it. It's not like anything is left out that we can't make sense of it. But it felt like, I don't know, it felt like it wasn't an American movie on some level, and I was wondering what your film influences were.
Yeah, I'm most of my influences come from European cinema, from the French New Wave to the Italian Neorealists. I started in Europe, actually. I was a photographer's assistant in Paris, France. And, European films are definitely a huge influence, and have been a huge influence on my career.
And also, one of the reasons, we make independent films is not to have films that answer every question like most of the studio films, the kind of formulaic, paint-by-numbers studio films where every single question is answered right there for you. You know, we want to make films that challenge people a little bit, at least.
Very much so. Are there any particular films that are your favorites?
Oh, God, there's so many. I mean, The Bicycle Thief, the conformist. There's just so many to list. I actually saw a brilliant film just the other day that's actually out in theaters called Let the Right One In. Absolutely amazing Swedish film that I highly recommend that people go out and see it.
Distinctive Scandinavian vampire film, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Beautifully done, extremely subtle, haunting, amazing. I mean, absolutely one of the best films I've seen in the last 5 years.
So how do you get an independent film like this made?
Oh, God, Jim,
great,
you want to?
Great difficulty. It's very, very hard right now in today's market to finance a film like this. They all want names. And because we've done films before, we knew names, but we decided that was a deliberate decision not to use names. And now that we've made it, it becomes even more difficult to market and distribute because they're all looking for names. So it's a very difficult time to make a film, however good, without names.
By names, you mean movie stars that everyone's heard of.
Right. That's correct.
Well, these actors, Nathan Wetherington and Steph Willen, are just first-rate actors. How did you find them?
I knew Nathan. We were going to do a project years ago. I had a project called Gertie that we almost got made, and then it got derailed. And he was going to be the lead in that. And that was, about 6 years ago. And then when I wrote M, I just thought he would be perfect for it. And then we went out and found Steph. But, yeah, but like Jim said, you know, I've been in the business since 1996, and I know how it works, how you need names, how you need all these certain elements. But we were talking about earlier, I wanted to make this film with no names for the reasons that you just what you said. And we knew, though, it was going to be an uphill battle in the distribution end of it with trying to sell the film. So creatively, I think we made the right choice, but financially, you know, it's gonna be tough.
So you're showing it in festivals. The film won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Seattle International Film Festival, and probably many other prizes coming as well because it's such a brilliant film. When a film does really well at festivals, what happens next? Does it make it easier for you?
In theory, it should make it easier, but the problem is that the distributors are just playing it because of the economy and because of the independent film market. The distributors are playing it overly safe, perhaps too conservatively, and are very, very reluctant to sign on a film without names. So there's a form of kind of there's a form of censorship in a way, because they want to only distribute films that are absolutely slam dunks, definitely going to make money for them, and they're unwilling to take chances with films that may make money for them, but not absolutely for sure.
Right. And you've just summed up the formula for American cinematic mediocrity.
Well, the problem is that the cinema audiences in America are really being deprived. They're really being deprived of a lot of great films domestically and internationally for this reason. It's a sad state of affairs. But the cinema audiences are not seeing films that have 4 or 5 stars, which is exceptional films, because decisions are being made on their behalf by companies out of just totally economic considerations.
Well, the film is, I think it is my pick of the festival for narrative films, at least. I haven't seen them all, but of the ones I've seen so far, it's brilliant and subtle and beautiful and very moving. It's called M. The website is myspace.com/EMthefilm, and you can check it out there, and you can see it, those of you who are in Santa Fe or will be in Santa Fe, this coming Friday, December 5th at 6:30, and then again Sunday at 8:15 at the DeVargas 2, and Jim Germanic will be also on a screenwriting panel on Sunday at 11 in the morning at Warehouse 21. Will you both be here for the Santa Fe Film Festival?
I unfortunately will not, but Jim, you're going to be there, right?
Yes, I'll be there. I'll be doing Q&As following both screenings.
Jim Germanic is the producer, and Tony Barbieri is the writer and director of the film M, which is spelled E-M. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to introduce Andy Abrahams-Wilson. He is director and producer of the documentary Under Our Skin, which screens at the Santa Fe Film Festival this week. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
This is an absolutely amazing documentary about Lyme disease, which it turns out most of us know very little about. At least that was my experience when, after watching the documentary. First of all, what is Lyme disease? How and when was the pathogen that caused it discovered?
It's a big question and a large can of worms. What is Lyme disease? The pathogen, the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, was discovered about 30 years ago, and it is a cousin of syphilis, so it's very similar to syphilis and has a lot of the similar symptoms, as a matter of fact. But the standard view about Lyme disease is that it's easy to diagnose and easy to treat. And therein lies the problem, because the doctors who are the so-called Lyme-literate physicians who are working on the front lines day in, day out with Lyme patients are saying, no, this is not easy to diagnose and it's not easy to treat. Patients go chronically infected, and if they're not treated early, if they're not diagnosed and treated early, they can go on to have symptoms, long-term symptoms possibly for the rest of their lives, and that it in some cases is fatal, and that it can be transmitted to their children, just like syphilis was transmitted in utero, and possibly even sexually transmitted. So it is possibly a very, very big epidemic that is going under the radar.
And so all of these things that you mentioned, I'd like to talk about. First of all, let's talk about diagnosis. First, it seems that many doctors don't look for it, but even when they do, the test yields a lot of false negatives. What's going on? Why is the testing not good enough, and is it improving?
Well, to answer the second part of your question, is it improving? I think I'd have to say no, it's not improving. As you said, there are a lot of false negatives, and the one of the problems is that there are many strains of the bacteria, and the standard tests only look for one strain, and it's generally accepted by, again, the Lyme-literate physicians, the ones who are working with Lyme patients, that the standard tests, not only are they not looking for different strains of the bacteria, but that they're also not very sensitive, and that they're missing some of the telltale markers of Lyme disease. Also, all patients don't create antibodies right away, so that's a problem. And sometimes antibodies are not created at all because of the way the bacteria act inside of the body. So we're actually going into sort of deep science here, and there's a lot of unknowns. And I think what is certain, despite the disagreement, is that we need more research, and our diagnostic tools need to be sharpened, and as well as questions around treatment.
How widespread is Lyme disease?
Excuse me?
How widespread is Lyme disease? How many cases are there?
Well, the CDC reports that there are around 20,000 cases per year in the United States. Now, by their own estimation, this is off by about 10-fold. So that would put the number at about 200,000. And just to give you a comparison, the AIDS numbers are about 30 to 40,000 per year. So it's a larger epidemic than AIDS, if you look at it that way. But the cases are not nearly accurate, because all states don't have mandatory testing, physicians, or rather mandatory reporting. physicians are not looking for the disease and don't know how to spot it. Like I said, even if they do, that they're not reporting it. And partly they're not reporting it because of if you're branded with Lyme disease, you will, or chronic Lyme disease, you will probably lose your insurance coverage. You will not get covered for chronic Lyme disease because it is not by most insurance companies listed as a valid medical condition.
How is it treated at early stages, if it is caught early, and subsequently?
Well, the most common treatment is antibiotics. And if Lyme disease is caught early, then that's the best defense. And it usually eradicates the bacteria. But the problem is people are not getting diagnosed early. And so they go on and they get chronic infection, and it's much more difficult to eradicate at that point. But I think it's also important to say that what is seen as Lyme disease now is not just infection with the Lyme disease bacteria, that it's probably a matter of co-infections with other organisms that are commonly found in the gut of the deer tick, which is how Lyme disease is generally transmitted.
Now, that's a very interesting point. The Lyme disease is transmitted through ticks, through these deer ticks, and the Lyme disease bacterium that is known is only one of the pathogens that's really causing the illness that doctors are seeing as Lyme disease. There's all these other co-infections going on. Is that why the rate of it is going up, because of these other factors, these other pathogens?
Well, you're asking me a lot of medical questions, and I think I should make it very clear to the audience that I'm a filmmaker.
Right.
And I'm a quick study, I guess. And I think it's valid to say I've become an expert on Lyme disease, but I'm really a filmmaker, and I can tell you what I found from my research. But I'm really not the authority in terms of certain medical questions, and that's why I'm usually the one who asks the questions, and
right.
and those are the people that I interviewed for the film.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, one of the narratives of the film is the resistance in the medical community to diagnosing and treating the illness, and it really sounded like the early AIDS days of AIDS and HIV. Except the people who have Lyme disease don't have the same stigmas. I mean, in the early days of AIDS, it was gay men, mostly gay men, and in the 80s, Haitians, mm-hmm. both of whom were stigmatized communities in their own ways. The people who have Lyme disease, I mean, it's named after Lyme, Connecticut, which is this white, upper-middle-class community. Why the stigma?
Well, first of all, I think that's a very valid comparison with AIDS, and with AIDS in the early part of the epidemic, that it was stigmatized, and there was very little known, just in the same way that we're seeing the same thing with Lyme disease right now, that people are not taken seriously, and very little is known, and there's certain assumption about what is known on the part of the medical establishment. But we're finding day by day that we don't know as much as we think about. Now, in terms of the stigmatizing of the people with the illness, people with Lyme disease are stigmatized. And whether they're from Lyme, Connecticut or not, they have routinely been told by their physicians at some point that there's nothing wrong with them, that it's all in their head. This is something that I've heard from almost, I'd say, 90% of the hundreds of people that I interviewed for the film, that at some point, as they've gone down the very long road of trying to find answers for what's wrong with them, they've been told time and time again that there really is nothing wrong with them, that it's just psychosomatic, that it's in their head.
Which is such an incredible insult when the symptoms that people have are so dramatic. I mean, some of the people whose stories you follow closely in the film over a long period of time are people who were athletic, healthy, robust people who were just leveled by this disease,
right,
and yet told that it was psychosomatic. I don't understand. It's hard to understand how that can, what's up with that.
Well, it is hard to understand what's up with that, and I think that was one of the motivations for my wanting to make the film, is a real sense of compassion for people who've suffered this injustice. Not only are they suffering an illness, which is completely devastating them, but they're also suffering a social illness, and they're outcast in some cases even within their own families. And many people have told me that that the film has been instrumental in helping people in their family or in their social circles understand what they've been going through. That not until having that validation on screen were people really able to understand what they've been going through.
Another narrative in the film is about the persecution of doctors who aggressively treat chronic Lyme disease with long-term antibiotics. So you have a medical establishment that says there is no such thing as chronic Lyme disease, and then you have these people who treat it with great success, and then they're persecuted by the medical establishment. Once again, what's going on there?
Well, boy, it's a really big question, and it's hard to sort of put it in a sound bite, but basically there's two camps. One camp says Lyme disease is easy to diagnose and easy to treat, and the other camp says, no, it's not easy to diagnose and it's not easy to treat. As a matter of fact, we need to treat with long-term antibiotics, not just the recommended 2 to 4 weeks, but sometimes months and months. Now, if you're going to be treating for that long, it's going to cost a lot of money. And who's paying for that? The insurance companies are paying for that. Insurance companies don't want to pay for that. And there's no reason that they're going to want to pay for that if an important governmental institution is sort of on their side, saying that chronic Lyme disease doesn't exist. So they've got a justification, a rationalization for denying treatment. But I think the greater question is why are some of the people who for so long have been involved in the research for Lyme disease intransigent about the chronicity of Lyme disease? And why are they going after the doctors who are treating with for long term? And when we look at that, we're really looking at the commercialization of medicine, and we're looking at conflicts of interest in medicine, that the people who are benefiting from the guidelines, the Lyme treatment guidelines, are the ones who are writing the guidelines. And that's sort of a sort of general explanation for what is going on. And as a matter of fact, the Attorney General of Connecticut looked at this very issue and discovered substantial conflicts of interest in the among the authors of the Lyme treatment guidelines in the IDSA, which is the Infectious Disease Society of America, and forced them to reconvene a guidelines writing committee with people who had no conflict of interest. The Lyme community is hoping that this will make a difference, and we'll see.
He comes across as a real hero in the film, which I hope a lot of people go see. We're talking about the film Under Our Skin, and its director and producer is Andy Abrahams-Wilson. Something that I found incredibly interesting and important in this film, and again, something that I didn't know about, nobody knows about it, is the potential link between Lyme disease and Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis, and Parkinson's. That is huge, and there seems to be some evidence for it.
Yeah, it is huge, and I'm glad you asked that question. Again, that was one of the things that got me really interested in this, is the stakes are huge. So many of the people that I've interviewed, so many of the people with Lyme disease have at some point been diagnosed with a sort of list of other conditions, including chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, lupus, multiple sclerosis, ALS, Parkinson's, and, as you say, even Alzheimer's. And specifically, one of the things that's very interesting to me and to some other research is the link between Lyme disease and neurodegenerative illness. We have one scientist in the film who's been studying this link for 20 years and has found substantial connections. For instance, in the brains of 7 out of 10 people who died from Alzheimer's disease, and these were brains that were taken from the Harvard University Brain Bank, he found DNA of the bacteria that causes Lyme, 7 out of 10. And his thesis basically is that Lyme does play a role in neurodegenerative illness such as Alzheimer's and as well as multiple sclerosis and ALS. And as a matter of fact, many of the Lyme-treating physicians will tell you that that they see patients who have been diagnosed with MS or ALS, and then once they get the treatment, the diagnosis and treatment for Lyme disease, they start to get better. Now, it's not to say that everybody who's diagnosed with MS or ALS or any of those conditions has Lyme disease, nor that they will get better by treating them for Lyme disease. But it's a fascinating discovery and a fascinating connection, which potentially could save thousands and thousands of lives. So it really needs to be looked at and studied further.
So what are your goals for getting the film out, not only to the public, but to the medical establishment? It seems like there's a tremendous potential for education of all sectors of society by your film.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the goal here is awareness. The Lyme community and the Lyme literate physicians have been fighting for years trying to create change, and it hasn't happened. And my belief is that the change has to happen from the ground up, that it's going to be about awareness. So it's not going to be just getting more research, because the research dollars are just going to go into the same hands of the people that have been getting it for years. It really needs to come from the people, and it's going to be by means of what I think is a major media event, which is our film, to help create that, so that it will enter into public consciousness and change public perception, and the people will demand answers. And when the people demand that their health be taken seriously, then we're going to start to get answers. And a good, I think, good comparison is the AIDS epidemic, and that's really the same way that happened. The change happened for AIDS.
Andy Abrahams-Wilson is director and producer of the documentary Under Our Skin, which screens at the Santa Fe Film Festival this week. It's screening on Thursday, the 4th of December at 12:45 in the afternoon at the Forum on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, and once again on Saturday at 5:45. There's much more to talk about, but people can just go ahead and see the film. They can also check it out at the website, which is underourskin.com. Andy, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks so much to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents the monthly Women in Jazz Hour. All this week, Santa Fe Film Festival, much more tomorrow and the next day. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR and KSFR.org. Hasta la vista. Ciao.